We'll be moving on to the next speaker, Dr. George Wortley of the University of Northampton, and he'll be speaking on Ebony Magazine and the Northampton Caribbean Diaspora.
Yes, just a few things before I start. I mean, I do have a few audio, I took three audio clips because I believe in giving people agency, which is sometimes different than how we usually do things in academia, in the sense that I refer to people interviewed by their names, which isn't normally accepted practice in academia, but I disagree with that practice in the sense that they've given their permission, obviously, but I do believe in giving people agency, and by mentioning who they are, they're proud to have shared this, you know, their stories with me, their history with me, that it's only fair to do that. So I mentioned that. Because, you know, it's about giving people agency. And I don't know if any of you have heard of Ebony Magazine, if you're American or know of American culture, but it was the preeminent African-American magazine, started in 1945. Still exists today, but obviously not as popular as it was back when magazines were more popular, 40s up until, I would say, even the 70s, 80s, really, was very, very popular. I mean, I remember as a kid, I did live in a historically African-American area. There weren't any other African-American families for miles around. But I do remember as a kid going into the area that was more majority African-American populated and reading Ebony there. It's the only time I ever actually read it because we didn't have it at home and anything like that. But the only reason I mention it because it helps you understand the subjects of that I'll be discussing and how they experience life here and why Ebony inspired them culturally in sort of a Pan-African black sense. So I start with that note. And before I go on, I'll just give you a brief history or just some statistics to just give you an idea of the isolation that Caribbean people felt in Northamptonshire. I mean, population 1906, only 500 out of 100,000 here. This is fairly typical of the percentage of population of Caribbean people outside of London, particularly. So these numbers aren't out of the ordinary. And even if you get to 1991, it's 0.8% of the population in Northamptonshire, the county, in 1991. So we're dealing with very small numbers of Caribbean people. So just to give you an idea of the cultural isolation that would have inspired people to look at Ebony and be inspired by it, amongst other movements in that time. So just to give you an idea there. And the other thing that I mentioned as well, and this is something that I would say I kind of differ from most academics in that I've, not most, but I think it's increasing understanding your positionality. I think in oral history, I mean, one of my main areas, oral history, is that we clearly examine our positionality as oral historians. And looking at that, being, you know, African-American and African-Caribbean as well, the dynamic there is something that I should have recognized when I started this research five years ago. I felt like I should have recognized, at least asked the question, but I didn't initially. It was obviously people presenting this information to me, but I didn't acknowledge it initially. But we'll get to that in more detail as I move on. But in terms of Ebony as a whole, there were 20 million, roughly at that point in 1970, about 20 million African American, and they sold 1.2 million copies of Ebony. And obviously with people, more than one person was reading a copy. I think John H. Johnson, the founder of Ebony, said for every copy sold, about 6 to 8 people read it. So if you're looking at that statistic, you could say roughly about 40-50% of African Americans read Ebony every month in 1970. So obviously a very wide-ranging cultural influence. And then getting back to the research that I did from 2008 to 2011, I interviewed 20 people, and 8 people clearly mentioned ebony as a cultural influence. And then after that as well, many people mentioned ebony locally, Caribbean, and other people of black origin, of African origin, mentioned ebony as influencing them in their lives in various ways. Seeking out this cultural influence that they didn't get because at that time from any other cultural influence in a similar way. So that just gives a bit of context. If we look at the post-war black press in Britain, most of the publications were short-lived or not readily available. You know, we had the West Indian Gazette, Claudia Jones, I mean, everybody's heard of Notting Hill Carnival. She had the West Indian Gazette, which is out for a relatively short period of time. But that's sort of, obviously she deserves a lot of credit for that, but it still wasn't sort of nationally available for any significant length of time. Benjamin, only Benjamin, she credits the West Indian World as being the first British-based nationally sold weekly newspaper in 1971. Then we move on into The Voice, and that's sort of the preeminent black newspaper, weekly produced, that's out now starting in 1982. So that just gives you a brief idea of what the post-war black press in Britain was about. But looking at it from a localized perspective is that there weren't many cultural influences, positive cultural influences for black people, particularly in the time that I was dealing with, which was the late 50s to the 80s, but particularly 60s, 70s, even early 80s. There weren't many positive cultural influences for black people in Britain. So this is why this, as ebony, was very important. We look at how black people were portrayed in the media at that time, you know, not only crime, but also I'm thinking of Linford Christie. When he won, he was British. When he lost, he was a second generation black British immigrant. You know, that type of mentality that was going on in those days. The denial of racism. You have the Sun denying that racism existed in the 80s. You have all of this context. So it's a dichotomy between what's real for black British people and Caribbean people and what the society was actually acknowledging. So ebony, if we're looking at ebony, these cultural influences are for Caribbean people. I'm speaking of Caribbean people specifically here, but looking at that in contrast with all the other cultural influences, as well as literally calling people alien as well. And that runs throughout the post-war era up until 2009. The Daily Mail article calling black people and Asian people as well alien in 2009. There was a big brouhaha article on that. So we have that context as well, but definitely in the 70s, in the 80s, even a local paper here, North Hampshire Chronicle and Echo, were calling black people aliens, even if they were born here in the 70s. So that's the context. And we have the discriminatory media, we have news television, shows like Love Thy Neighbor, also add to this discriminatory mentality towards black people in this era. Particularly, we're dealing with mainly for the purposes of the research that I did, mainly 60s to the 80s. And ebony would have been read as a means of combating this discrimination that existed in all these other media and cultural influences. Then we need to be looking at also the connections between African Americans and African American culture and black British or Caribbean struggles. Within that context, we also had a number of military base, American military bases in the area as well. And what happened often, I know this is not the subject of Ebony, but just to give you an idea of this, was that they had a pub, right? Not far from where, if you're going out to dinner later, actually right around the corner from the restaurant that we'll be eating at is it the Boston now? Did they change the name again? I can't remember. But it used to be the Mitre, and it used to be Irish people used to go there, and Caribbean people, also American GIs would go there, because you have to remember that there's still the segregationist mentality in America as well. So all these people would get together, go there, and they would learn from each other as well. Exchange music, maybe get in a few fights as well sometimes, but most of the time it's just exchanging various culture. So all of these things were means of Caribbean people here trying to be positive about being black. Yeah? So an understanding there were similar struggles, the differences, but there were similar struggles going on in America and here about equality and respect. So that's what it was. But also differences. Obviously, I said before, 20 million African Americans in America, and the population of Caribbean people in 1961 was less than 200,000. So, you know, for anybody to say that there was this scare of Caribbean people coming here, it's absolutely ridiculous. But the numbers were very, very small. Now, so we're looking at that. So you're dealing with markets as well. So obviously, if you have 20 million people to market to, you can obviously have a much more viable business than if you're potentially marketing to only 170,000. So just to give you a bit of context. And then also some similarities that in America, there's this unwritten rule that particularly in the South, that black people couldn't be peer and print, less connected with the crime. And this sort of still existed even into definitely the 70s in America, because I know one newspaper, the New York Daily News, was pretty bad about as soon as they report a crime, they mention the person's ethnicity. And that definitely existed here as well. So there's similarities between America and Britain. And John H. Johnson recorded that, because some of the history with John H. Johnson and Ebony was that there's a magazine called Life in America. A lot of pictures in there. And John H. Johnson, the founder of Ebony, saw that Life magazine was selling very well in African-American communities. Even if they were poor, they were still buying Life because they enjoyed that. And what he recognized was that, what if he could sell a magazine that was dedicated to African-American people to celebrate being African-American? And then from that, he eventually created Ebony as a means of creating ethnic pride for African-American people to feel proud about themselves. So that's the brief history of Ebony. But the connection between the crime of only black people could only be reported about crime in America and here, it's very, very similar, is that a lot of the media, when it was portraying ethnicity, was sort of portraying black people as being very negative in the 1990s and earlier. And Benjamin notes that. But also the political context of it, in popular culture, the National Front were portrayed as the first group to create the Keep Britain White slogan, but actually it was Winston Churchill in 1955. He was debating keeping Keep Britain White as a campaign slogan for the 1955 election. So he actually was the first one to do it, not the any sort of far-right organization. But the idea of creating black people as other is the main concept. So when we're looking at Ebony, we also need to look at all of the cultural and social and political influences surrounding the portrayal of black people in this era. And Caribbean people, they read Ebony, they sat here, culturally isolated, and Ebony was like a beacon to them. Ebony was a beacon because of all of these various negative influences, and also being bullied in schools, which was rife for Caribbean children to experience, particularly boys. When they read Ebony, it was like a beacon to them. They saw black people portrayed very positively, celebrating success, And this was very, very powerful to people here, especially because, you know, basically they wanted, you know, they wanted respect and equality, which wasn't happening here. It's very similar to African American struggle. And also in terms of the struggle, we had younger, particularly younger men, because younger men were more likely to be excluded from youth clubs, for example, and other social opportunities. They met right out here in a race course because they couldn't go to youth clubs. They met there, and they were exchanging their experiences and learning from each other. One person even went and changed his name, actually. I mean, if you would understand the concept of Afrocentricity, part of that belief is that English, and I put that in inverted brackets, or Europeanized names are representative of slave culture. So the idea of if you're an Afrocentric thinker, you change your name to an Afrocentric, based on somewhere in usually West Africa, as a result of embracing your Africanness. So one guy, his birth name was Trevor Hall, but he changed his name to Ras Jabalani and moved to Zimbabwe because of his experiences being very ostracized and isolated here, and that was a way of experiencing his positivity. And Ebony was part of this experience that younger Caribbean men particularly had. But I'll go into that in more detail. But also, one of the questions that I had that led me to this area is that Ebony is seen as an African-American magazine, which is what it is. But what isn't really in literature is how it influenced people of African origin outside of America. And that's really my main interest in this. Haile Selassie read Ebony. He said, he basically, Johnny Johnson quoted him, letting the people know the word about the world, people of the world know about the progress of American blacks. So it's sort of a pan-Africanism that Selassie is expressing through this quotation. But other than that, there isn't much, I haven't found any literature really that's expressed any sort of, as analyzed in any way, how African people outside, particularly people of African origin, outside of the diaspora, has embraced Ebony in any sort of way. So this is really the main purpose to push this issue out there a little bit. And it should be more research done, but I'll get to that as I move on. And I won't go into this in more detail, but it's basically positive and celebratory black achievements, because you're going to see, you know, you see people like Muhammad Ali, you'll see Diana Ross, but also within articles you'll see professional African-American people that have been successful as well. I do remember one article, there was a general, I can't remember his name, General Davis, and he was one of the first African-American generals, and this was in Ebony. So this was actually very, very powerful. And this is what was celebratory. Clearly celebratory blackness, which wasn't being celebrated largely in Britain in print form. Now, one of the things that, to use an example, there was this article that I, front cover actually, I used as ephemera, and I'll have the picture on the next slide, is the new black middle class. And I use this as ephemera because once this issue came up, I said, okay, fine, I'll pick an article, New Black Little Class, and see what people have to say, see what my interviewees had to say about it. And I was quite powerful. And one of my interviewees, Baptiste, Week Baptiste, somebody I didn't know at the time, but I know quite well now, which is one of the beauties of research sometimes, they articulate this duality between the negative images he had about black people or that he experienced in being in Britain and the positive black images of black people in Ebony that countered such negativity. And this is what he was saying, August 1987, front cover, the new black middle class, and you see this picture here. You weren't going to see that in Britain at that time, anywhere.
I don't think you would see that because there isn't much of a black middle class, definitely not at that time, and I would argue even now there isn't that much of a black middle class as a whole in the UK. For reasons I won't go into now, but the statistics do play that out. But this is the picture that Weeks Baptiste, one of my interviewees, was looking at when he gave this comment that, well, that you'll look at and listen to in the next slide.
When the Jew was, you know, being betrayed in that way, so all my life as a kid, living in England, that's the image of black people I saw on television. And then all of a sudden, everybody would come along, and imagine seeing an image like that. I mean, to me, that was brilliant. What I got out of it.
Yes, what this means says, for the record, the new black middle class, this is an issue from August 1987.
Yeah.
Of Ebony.
Yeah, I mean, the idea you've got this guy that's in a suit, you know, you've got this beautiful woman next to him, that was great, that to me was positive. You know, and thank God I saw these images, because if I continue seeing the images that I was familiar with on the TV, in programs like Times, I mean, TV programs that were on British TV, things like mm-hmm. The Neighbours and various adverts or that portrayed black people, you know, kind of negative line. I mean, thank God this came along, because he was really, he did some positive and stole my images, and that's what I got out of it.
Right.
Fantastic.
Now, what about, I don't know if you listen to James Brown.
Okay. So, that was just one of my interviewees' understandings of an impression that he got from reading Ebony. And you see this duality between the British-centric, and I would even take it to a further level, Eurocentric, education, and I'll put that in inverted brackets, or things that he learned, or things, cultural manifestations of Britishness and anti-blackness that he saw in media, cultural, social circumstances, and then seeing Ebony, which was totally opposite of that, where he could not only look at the images positively, but also as an extension of that, looking at himself positively. So it's not quite Afrocentric thinking, because that's something that's totally different, but it's a movement towards that, being positive. Instead of imbibing Eurocentricity, it's actually using it as a form of rejecting the more malevolent form of Eurocentricity and embracing Afrocentricity or Pan-Africanism on some level. Yeah. So this is what he was experiencing by reading Ebony and able to contrast that with the negative images of blackness and Afrocentricism and the negative image of blackness as expressed in media, society, and culture. And also a number of things that people saw was the power. Now they saw that black people had power in America through reading Ebony that they didn't have here. I won't go into that in too much detail because there isn't much time, but they viewed it as a stimulus in the summation. They viewed it as a stimulus. Ebony, there was prohibitive in terms of cost, in terms of buying Ebony, but it was definitely shared. It was shared amongst the younger generation. It was shared amongst the older generation as well, in different ways. The young generation, they were out here, they were sharing Ebony amongst other works, like, I won't say the quote, but they were sharing other books like Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, Jay Rogers' The 100 Days of Facts About the Negro, very interesting books, and it was used to develop ethnic pride. Ebony shouldn't be seen in isolation. It should be seen alongside other forms of media, print media, that were used to uplift ethnic identity. So that's a very important point. It wasn't independent of other things. It was definitely within a framework. But I'll go towards finishing on this note. Not all experiences of reading Ebony were positive. One of the things that is still an issue in the African-American community and even South Asian community as well is skin bleaching. And there were many adverts about skin bleaching and ebony. And one of my interviewees explained that was very negative. She said that there were skin lightening creams such as Pond Vanishing Cream that sought to diminish visible blackness while a magazine promoted. So there was a duality there that she didn't like. And then there were other dilemmas that were expressed because of, and I'll play this quote, I'll play this
meaning ebony obviously being an African-American magazine. What did you, as a Caribbean British person, a Caribbean person living here in Britain, what did you get out of reading Ebony?
It was a very confusing scenario for me reading Ebony, because it was very American, total different experience to myself as a black person, both here and in the Caribbean. In fact, some of the documentary, the write-ups, I couldn't identify with at all. But it became a challenge to me to try and get a link between the Caribbean, as in, Britain, blackness, and the American black experience. And trying not to do what people wanted you to do, but say, so after them, they're Americans. Because Americans will be saying the same about Caribbean. So I feel like that Caribbean. One of the issues I had with Ebony was that the American reading it, you would think that it only happened to black Americans. And that your blackness relied on being an American. Your slavery role relied on coming through from the American roots. Because Caribbean was very different, I felt.
So this clip, it's a search for identity here. It's an expression of Pan-Africanism, although she didn't quite word it that way, but it's definitely an expression of a desire for Pan-Africanism to say, look, we are all people of African origin. We should see what our similarities are rather than our differences, that there is a common struggle that she struggled with, but she saw what the common struggle with, what was rather. And this is actually the main point that I'm trying to make, is that despite whatever similarities there were between African Americans and African Caribbean people, that this commonality of struggle came through. It came through throughout the interviews, this struggle for power and the struggle for respect and the struggle for having something in common as people of African origin. So to sum up, the influence of Ebony on Northamptonshire Caribbean is a part of limited knowledge of how this magazine influenced the African diaspora outside of the United States. So I would argue, and maybe I might do some research on this in the future, is to look at what was happening elsewhere in Britain in terms of how Ebony influenced not only Caribbean people, anybody that could be considered of African origin, to determine what was the extent of the influence of Ebony on the identity or identity-related influences on people of African origin. But based on what I've presented here, that Ebony was used, and I would, if I had to project, I would probably argue that Ebony was used elsewhere in Britain to promote blackness or promote Pan-Africanism positively. But the one thing I will mention before I finish is that mobile hairdressers, that's the part that I skipped, was that these magazines were shared because of the expense. So what people would do is mobile hairdressers, they come up from London, they come up for, let's say, a Saturday, they work out of someone's house, they bring up Ebony while they're sitting there for about two, three, four hours. I know I used to do this as a kid on a handful of occasions, forced to go with my mother, and I'd have to sit there for hours, and that's part of the time I read Ebony as well. And this is what was happening. So this is how Ebony was shared amongst Caribbean people. Even when there was a first Joyce Martin, she was the first hairdresser, black hairdresser here, and she had Ebony there as well. So just to give, just like you go to a hairdressing salon or you go to a barbershop, they have magazines to read. Ebony was the preeminent magazine for Caribbean people to read. And I just, hopefully there'll be some future research for myself or others to determine the extent of how Ebony was used to promote positive Pan-African or Black identity elsewhere in Britain. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George, for a very interesting paper. So the floor is open now for comments and questions to our two speakers. Elizabeth and George, please.
Yes. Thank you both, speakers. That was interesting. There's quite nice connections between the two of them as well. Questions really to George. I really enjoyed what you presented. It would be nice to see more of the images. The next time you present it, just have more of the images to give us a kind of a feel. I mean, that slide works really well about the middle class, but it would be really nice to see some others alongside that. I just want to kind of interrogate you a bit further, just to kind of convince me on the argument about Black and Pan-African. I get it in the sense of the way you presented it, and I'm sure there's wider data which supports it, but my experience of growing up in Birmingham, in Aston and Handsworth, and you know, growing up in a neighbourhood which was Jamaican, Caribbean and South Asian, I got a sense that the debates were slightly different about Pan-Africanism, which came from American, African-American in a particular way, and the debates which were happening about Pan-African and Black in Britain. So it was a sense of being connected through roots and history that this was part of our heritage, but it wasn't necessarily a kind of a political project as such in the way that the pages of Ebony might have suggested, or certainly in the way in which some of the rhetoric took place in African America. So I know, and sometimes you use the terms interchangeably in the pages. So really just to qualify that, were the two coterminous, Black in Britain and Pan-African? My lived experience and work that I've done around Black British identity suggests not quite so, but I'd really be welcome to hear what you found in relation to that.
Well, what I would say on that is that I would totally agree with your point in the sense that Black Britain doesn't equate with Pan-African. I mean, even if we see now, if we were to ask, you know, Caribbean people, or people that consider themselves Black British, if they consider themselves African origin, I venture to say a lot of people wouldn't actually, in terms of their ethnicity, with different than cultural manifestations, their ethnicity. So on that level, I would agree with that. However, what I have seen is that there's this desire to have a pan-Black identity, if you will, if it's not a pan-African identity, because the two terms are different. That being said, it's the inspiration behind Ebony as well, is to look at themselves as in Caribbean people positively as Black people. And I think that definitely comes through. It comes through throughout the interviews I've done. It came through throughout other people that I've discussed this issue with that are of Caribbean or any other sort of African diaspora. So I think that's actually a critical issue. But also, if we look at Eurocentricity as well, in the sense that Black was seen as negative through a variety of manifestations, if we look at it that way, Ebony is on the opposite spectrum of that. So even if somebody's not necessarily Pan-African, they're still going to look at Blackness positively, even if they don't embrace Pan-Africanism.
And if I may just add, you know, that I think, you know, that's one of the causative, you know, aspects, you know, of the subject of your paper, that what it seems to be doing is highlighting, you know, reinforcing, you know, the similarities. Whereas, you know, most of the time, you know, what you get, unlike, you know, what you would expect, is, you know, just talk about, you know, the differences, you know, between, you know, the different, you know, Black, you know, communities. There's no denial, you know, in such arguments, you know, that, you know, the Black community is not homogeneous. Most of the time, you know, the stress is on, you know, those differences, those factors, you know, that separate, you know, the different, you know, Black communities. So it's good, you know, to see, you know, something, you know, that actually rallies, you know, the Black communities, you know, and reinforces or highlights, you know, those aspects of similarities.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add to that is that even in terms of Caribbean, you know, and I've argued this in my thesis, as well as one of my articles I've written, is that Caribbean isn't actually an ethnic identity, as in an ethnic, a natural ethnic identity. It's not like being, I don't know, French or being, you know, Nigerian or a particular ethnic group. And like, for example, it's actually a construct that was created as a result of opposing itself to Eurocentricity and being perceived as negative in the war period, in the Second World War, and a little bit afterwards. So what you had in Britain is you had this tension between Jamaica and other Caribbean countries. So where Jamaica, because Jamaica is bigger than the other Caribbean islands, you know, some of the derision was towards calling people small islanders, which you, people in the 50s and 60s did. But the reality was after a lot of ethnic violence, then there had to be unity because the numbers of Caribbean people were relatively small, regardless of what country you came from. So therefore, there had to be a unity because of this cultural isolation. So you weren't seeing yourself as from, you know, Barbados or Bermuda or wherever. You were seeing yourself as a Caribbean person as a result of the racialized opposition to Caribbean and black people that was expressed in Britain.
Just got a quick question.
Yes, please.
It's interesting that you're talking about second and third centuryness in diaspora studies and the example of NW, which clearly is about sort of local habitation and neighbourhood sort of intimacy, familiarity, that there should be a murder in the midst of this celebration of close proximity and home, and, you know, doesn't it suggest that the uncanny sort of lies within, and that it's really not...
It's a very dark novel, so much less than a celebration it would be.
So
kind of bit. I don't know, yeah. Well, it's a very interesting thing that it is timed the way it is. So you have the sort of, it's quite explicit. You have Felix's life being quite finally settled. He has just left his former lover's home, finally broken things off with her, and she's this sort of crack addict of sorts who was tearing him down, and he just wanted a new life, and then he gets murdered. But there's a sense there of inevitability that in some way tries to be combated. So you have Cortia Newlands' work in that novel I mentioned, The Scholar, which is about two sort of cousins, and one of them is the scholar who is quite, he wants to get out, they live on a council estate, his cousin, and he's been adopted, the scholar has been adopted because his father, one of the cousins was adopted because his father was murdered by the police in a sort of racial incident. And one of them is part of this drug world, and there's an inevitability that something bad will happen, and the other one is really trying to get out and is studying, etc. And then through a sort of very strange series of events, he ends up being sort of put in jail for murder, one that he sort of might have committed, and the other cousin goes on the run. And there's a weird way in which what are these authors trying to do? So what I did want to say that might connect our papers in a very interesting way is you have these positive figurations, positive representations that people are taking up and really embracing, and that is allowing them to figure something out about themselves and how they see themselves. And I was wondering if this is a magazine which I've encountered in the US, and it is, you know, sort of prominently on the sort of magazine shelf. And I wonder what literature plays, what role it can play, if you have this sort of negative figuration or something kind of difficult. So you have these authors, and oftentimes we turn to literature in diaspora studies to see ourselves reflected, right? Somebody which is a member of that community would pick up this novel and see this something happen, and what would happen if they were reading NW, even though Sadie Smith would never consider herself a diasporic author, I don't think. She wouldn't consider herself a black British diaspora for various reasons. But I wonder what the connection is there between magazines positively representing something in literature, what literature does, because you have Penguin marketing these things, and you have the way the covers are marketed. Oftentimes they're very much a cover of Courtney Newland novel. It's very, some of them are not very tasteful, but they look kind of like pulpy. They look very, you have very much the ending of the novel represented, and the net ending is quite negative. I don't know if you deal with other sort of mediums of visual representation of the Black British community, besides Ebony, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, my what I've done is more in terms of oral history,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't touched the visual. Some media,
yeah.
But I actually my role is more to serve as seeing connections,
mm-hmm.
between, so it's more social. So I could see the links between that, and it's something that I would explore in future to see what other elements there are, but it's not something that I've really dealt with much.
And I mean, one grand example would be the way Zadie Smith has been taken up as an icon of a particular community,
yeah.
whether she wants to be or not, is a different question. And the way her novels have been marketed as these local urban things when they might not be, or when she might not identify.
But the question that I would have in terms of your work, your research, is that if we're looking at, because you have two different levels of interpretation, two levels of representation. There's a representation of being Black for Black people,
yeah,
and there's a representation of Blackness that's for a wider market or Eurocentric market, and the two aren't necessarily the same. I mean, to give an example that's totally different, rap music, which is something that I know a bit about, in the beginning it was urban protest music. Then somewhere around the late 80s, early 90s, when the majority of rap was actually sold to white people, then it started to change into gangster rap after that time, once they realized the market wasn't actually to sell to African American and other Black people. There was actually a market into portraying Black people in a particular way, which is negative, but it was still selling, so therefore, that's what I would argue would have caused a change in that. So, I mean, my question is, in terms of literature, was the literature you're discussing sort of marketed towards Black British people, or is it marketed to a wider audience?
Well, you have Zadie Smith, who's this mainstream person, who's obviously the sort of marketed to whoever will have her, and everyone would, it seems. But, it's a very interesting question because it is about labels, right? So you have the Black British section of a bookshop, and then who is that marketed towards? But then you would have the question of what you're bringing up, that in anthropology, I think it's the emic and the etic, right? The sort of how a community represents itself to itself versus how a community is represented by the academics and how it is discussed by the outside. And I think it depends who you ask, right? So if you would ask somebody like Courtney Newland, he's just saying, I'm just writing London novels, right? I have nothing really to do with the diaspora. And I happen to be of Caribbean origin, he says, but I'm writing for everyone. And then what it ends up being taken up is something like The Express, right? Do you know the press The Express, which was a sort of underground press that then ended up becoming quite mainstream with, I think, the novel was Yardie, right? That was the sort of famous one that they did. And then they were sort of discredited because they were more about sensationalism, etc. It's an interesting question, and of course I sort of kind of have to struggle, but I don't know if we have the time to...
No. Unfortunately, no. In case we have any urgent questions or comments, I'm sure you know there will be opportunities to meet with two speakers, either here or as the dinner venue. And I'll just hand over to Janet.
No, just want to thank you for coming, and it's been a long day, but I hope you've enjoyed it.